This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Thank you for joining us for our radio Main Street all across North Dakota this time of day. And it streams live around the world at the same time. And then, of course, we archive it online at prairiepublic.org. You can find it anytime you want. And today we're going to start the show and finish the show talking about what is a popular pastime when it gets cold and gray and long, dark days outside, and that's going to the films. And today we've got a reason to talk about it, because the National Film Registry has picked its 25 choices of classic movies to add to the National Film Preservation Project. And joining us to talk about these movies and about the project, Matt Olien. He is a Prairie Public employee and our Main Street film reviewer. Always a pleasure to have you in studio, Matt.
Thanks, Doug. Looking forward to it.
And Greg Carlson's often here as well to talk with us about movies. Greg is a Concordia College film professor.
Glad to be here.
Let's talk first about what this is. What is the National Film Registry?
Well, it was formed how many years ago now, Greg? 20-some?
Yeah, 1989 was the first year of picks.
Okay.
And it came as a result of legislation. A National Film Preservation Act of 1988. So it was the following year they chose the first 25.
And what it's supposed to do, Doug, is preserve these films in the best form, the best quality that they can do. Now, over the years, this has kind of grown from a list of, you know, Casablanca, Citizen Kane types films to really culturally significant films. And what we're seeing this year, and we'll get to these, are more films by women directors that they have found to put on, and that's great. But we see culturally significant films. We also see historical footage of, you know, immigrants landing at Ellis Island, things like that. So it's not just Casablanca, Citizen Kane, Gone with the Wind. It's what they deem to be important.
And Greg, what do we mean by preserving these? What do they have to do?
So they actually hold materials in the Library of Congress, and sometimes those materials come from the big studios that might own the copyrights of the films. But in many cases, there are independent films in which the filmmaker holds the best available material, whether that's a negative or a high-quality print made from a negative. And that physical content then is preserved for future generations in the Library of Congress.
And I remember years ago there was a lot of talk about the necessary step of preserving films, particularly those that were originated on nitrate stock, because that's like gun cotton. That's explosive stuff.
Yes, it is.
And that can be important for films like Becky Sharp, which we're going to talk about, and some of those, you know, old films that really had to be preserved.
Okay, well, let's look at this list of films that are culturally, historically, or aesthetically significant. We'll go alphabetically. Amadeus, 1984.
Well, I remember seeing this when it came out. I was in college. It was a big deal to go to this movie. What Amadeus did, I think, and Greg can weigh in too, is it combined a biopic, but it made it entertaining. And so there was a lot of maybe not controversy, but there was some thoughts about how Tom Hulce played Mozart in the movie. His portrayal was quite a rather rambunctious performance. It's quite outlandish. He laughs a lot, and people were like, that doesn't really seem like Mozart, but what do we know about that? So it had two great lead performances, Tom Hulce, F. Murray Abraham, both competing at the Oscars, and F. Murray Abraham did win as Salieri. But everything, sumptuous production, Milos Forman, director, and one of those films that everybody liked at the time.
Well, I think those two actors make each other better in that film, because Hulse's rambunctious performance contrasts so perfectly with the dour kind of introspection of Salieri. They make a dynamic duo on screen. I love Amadeus.
Well, it was amazing visually, and the costumes are out of this world. And I had the great pleasure of seeing that movie, having worked with two of the actors who were in it. So it was a lot of fun for me.
Oh, really?
Fabulous.
Also, Oscar-related, this is the last time two actors were nominated from the same film in the lead performance. We have seen a trend since then, and you're going to see it this year with DiCaprio and Pitt from Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, where they will separate the actors into lead and supporting because they don't want them taking votes away. You could argue F. Murray Abraham possibly could have been in the supporting category, which would have probably won the film a couple Oscars. One more, probably.
Let's move on to Becky Sharp, which was produced in 1935.
This is important for one reason. Three-strip Technicolor, the first, I believe, Greg film to be shot in three-strip Technicolor. Ray Renahan was the was the cinematographer who went on to shoot Gone with the Wind. And if you look at the film now, the color looks a little muddy. It doesn't look as crisp as, say, 3-4 years even after that with Robin Hood, Gone with the Wind, and Wizard of Oz. But that's why it's important. Miriam Hopkins is a very good actress. She's good in the part. Her only
Got
Oscar
nomination.
That was her only nomination. But that's really why it's important, Greg.
Yeah, there's a documentary that's contained on the, I believe it's the Adventures of Robin Hood special edition DVD that's all about the evolution and history of Technicolor. And it features Becky Sharp significantly in that piece. It's, if you're a movie lover, it's worth seeking out that. It's kind of a, you know, extra bonus piece on this disc, but it's worth seeing.
How did they shoot three strip Technicolor? Is that three rolls of film in the same camera or what?
I'm not the guy to ask. Greg, do you have a thought on that?
we wish that either Rusty Castleton or Ted Larson was here to fill in the details about that. But I recall, in that documentary I mentioned, it breaks down the tech in a way that the average person can understand how the process works. But prior there was the two strip Technicolor, and prior to that, hand tinting and hand coloring, dyeing film to create color.
Yeah, so Greg makes a good point. Mystery of the Wax Museum, that would have been two strip Technicolor a couple years before. This looks much better.
We should mention that Ted Larson and Rusty Castleton are the late great Ted and Rusty, both film collectors and film teachers as well.
And Doug, if I can mention, it was very expensive to shoot in three-strip Technicolor at the time. That's why most films were shot in black and white at the time.
Before Stonewall is the third film, 1984 again, same year as Amadeus.
I haven't seen this one. I don't believe Greg has seen it either.
I have not.
It's historically significant.
It is. It's a 1984 documentary directed by Greta Schiller with the co-director credit by Robert Rosenberg. And it's, you know, the story this year in the film preservation selections for the Library of Congress has been what Matt mentioned at the top of the show, all about trying to get more films directed or at least co-directed by women in the registry. This year is the most, an unprecedented 7 titles directed by women is the most in a single year that we've had to date, even though here's a stat that they're working hard to remedy. Only about 60 of the 775 films in the entire registry are directed by women.
So this is a good step this year. Again, this film interviews a lot of people, Doug, that were involved with the Stonewall riots in 1969. So it's from what I understand from researching it, archival footage, interviews with people who were there at the time. So this would be a film to check out.
Historically, this is 1969. New York City police raided the Stonewall Inn, a gay bar in Greenwich Village, and that's the story. Body and Soul is the fourth film, 1925. This is an old one.
Yeah, this is the great Paul Robeson's screen debut, and he plays a dual role in the film. I've seen parts of it. It was directed by the great African-American filmmaker Oscar Michaud. And typical of what were, you know, broadly called race films at the time, it has some really fascinating themes of morality and ethics. And Robeson, you know, would go on to be one of the earliest African-American screen stars. And I believe that Criterion has this film available.
I think they do, yeah.
So I think it's on a Paul Robeson collection or a dual disc or something like that.
Well, earlier this year, there was kind of a Michaud series on the Movie Channel, which I love, and I got to see Paul Robeson in this particular movie. And I noted in the notes about this that this was a color-tinted movie originally.
I didn't know that.
I didn't know that. Yeah.
They used something called the Desmet method.
Huh.
But yeah, Turner Classic, I want to give them a shout-out like you just mentioned, Doug. They ran a bunch of Oscar Michaud films, and they're fascinating to watch. And Robeson plays this kind of con artist preacher in the movie who's got a twin brother as well.
Uh-huh.
A lot of silent films have a lot of that kind of twin switching things. There's a lot of films like that in the silent era. I'm not sure why. Mary Pickford did stuff like that usually.
All right. Boys Don't Cry, 1999.
I believe Hilary Swank still holds the record for the least amount of money she was paid for a Best Actress win. I want to say, Greg, this film was low budget.
Yeah.
Despite Swank was not known at the time, Chloe Sevigny was kind of known, but not really. And I want to say that Hilary Swank made like $3,000 or something like that and won the Best Actress Oscar.
Surely a labor of love for filmmaker Kimberly Pierce. Mm-hmm. A powerful, powerful film, a film that can be very difficult to watch. Also featured heavily in the documentary, This Film Is Not Yet Rated, about the controversy surrounding the depiction, the depictions of sex on screen. I remember seeing it at the Fargo Theater, and it was... It's an electrifying film.
Hilary Swank played a transgender man, a woman electing to live as a transgender man. And this movie was released a year after the murder of Matthew Shepard. So this raises, again, those LGBTQ plus issues that have been showing up in movies.
It's based on a true story. Brandon Tina was the name of the Hilary Swank character, and certainly – certainly this would be a very prescient film by today's standards as well, with so much being paid attention to LGBTQ issues. But at the time, you know, you had to go to an alternate cinema, independent cinema, to see this film. And once people saw it, this kind of Oscar buzz started to surround Hilary Swank and Chloe Sevigny, who was up for the Supporting Actress Oscar, and Swank won.
Okay. Next is a low-budget movie that made a lot of money and made a couple of guys pretty famous, Clerks, 1994.
This one was, I believe, for this year's National Film Registry, the highest vote-getter among the public nominations. So it shows the kind of cult following that Kevin Smith enjoys among his fans. One of the cool things about the National Film Registry is that anyone in America can make nominations for the films to be included. And if you go to the Library of Congress website, you can see they keep lists available to look at of prominent films that haven't yet made it over the hump and gotten included in the registry.
Just like Boys Don't Cry, this film was made on a shoestring budget, made a lot of money. I would call this Kevin Smith's Citizen Kane. I don't believe he has ever come close. Greg may disagree.
No, I don't disagree. I don't even know if he has a Lady from Shanghai or A Touch of Evil. I just don't.
Or an Ambersons. Right. I don't think there is one. Or a Chimes at Midnight. No. His output since has been, I would call it substandard, but this is a film that everyone saw at the time.
Greg, you mentioned that anyone can nominate a film.
That's right.
Go online and do that. But how are they chosen?
There's a board made up of film preservation experts, industry professionals, and others, as well as librarians of Congress. I know Martin Scorsese is one of the members of the board, and he has a film we'll be discussing a little later on the list today. But I'm not sure how – I don't think the actual voting process is made public, but they do provide lists of what the nominees are. And I have – we know several people who every year – like to share their they throw a couple titles in for consideration.
That's Concordia College film professor Greg Carlson. He's joined by Madeline, our Main Street film reviewer. We're looking at the 2019 National Film Registry picks, the 25 films that were chosen for preservation this year. We'll have more of our discussion in a moment.
When you hear arts programming here on Prairie Public, know that it is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, and we thank them.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Lacey's Custom Jewelry of Bismarck, a boutique jeweler offering custom work, remake, repair, and appraisal. Open Monday through Saturday during the holiday season. LaceysCustomJewelry.com.
Well, with a lot of folks, a holiday tradition is going to the movies, and today we're talking about the 25 films chosen for this year's National Film Registry Preservation Project. And we're talking with Madeline and Greg Carlson, a couple of movie, well, they love movies and they know a fair amount about them, so let's talk about the next one. Coal Miner's Daughter, 1980.
I was a little surprised to see this one on there. Not that it's not a good film, but just a little surprised that it's on there. But it certainly did one thing, and it sparked kind of, I would say there's been a trend that if you want to win an Oscar, play a real-life person that was a singer or songwriter. And we've seen lots of nominations through the years. Sissy Spacek does her own singing in the film. She's very good in the film. I remember watching the Oscars that year. It was kind of a given that she would win the Academy Award. So it's a good film. Tommy Lee Jones was in it as well. Certainly kind of gives you that hardscrabble beginning that Loretta Lynn had. But, you know, it's not a great film. I would say it. I would call it a good film.
Well, Sissy Spacek earned an Academy Award.
There were lots of Best Actress winners on this year's list.
Yes.
Of the 25 films. Well, we've mentioned several nominees and a couple winners already, and we've got more yet to come on the list.
Yes, we do.
So that's another interesting trend. Mm-hmm. That, you know, people who love trivia like Matt will look at sort of the what are the stats? What's the stat line on these films?
All right, well, let's go to the next one, which is Immigrants Landing at Ellis Island, 1903, and this is one of the things I love about movies as a time machine, because it really shows you what life was like over 100 years ago.
The film is exactly as the title says it is, shot by the Edison Company. You can watch it online. It's not very long, and it shows people coming to Ellis Island with their belongings from all kinds of countries. It doesn't say which countries, but you can kind of pick out where some of these folks might be from. Just a fascinating idea for the Edison Company to go shoot this, to go film this, and now we all get to see it. Just great stuff to look at.
Yeah, it's a history that comes to life. It's amazing to me. Employee's Entrance is the next one, 1933. I have seen this movie, and I found it very intriguing.
I'm a fan of this movie as well. I got to see it first, courtesy of Ted Larson, who owned a print of it. And he really loved these pre-code movies, films that were before the Motion Picture Producers Association and the Motion Picture Production Code became established, that allowed industry self-censorship. The content was a bit looser.
You push
some boundaries of what you see. And Warren William, who often played these, you know, really sharp, hard-edged kind of, he was sort of like the dark side of William Powell. You know,
yes,
I always
yes.
saw him as like if William Powell was the angel on one shoulder, Warren William was the devil on the other shoulder. But he's terrific in the movie, and Loretta Young is his co-star.
And doesn't he play Greg? I've not seen this kind of, he's the boss of the company, and of course he...
It's a department store.
He wants the women to do favors for him.
That's right.
To work for
him. The title implies it deals with coercion and exploitation and the challenges faced, particularly by young women who were trying to advance without being exploited within a company.
And Loretta Young is his target. Mm-hmm. But I would add that Warren Williams is sort of the bad guy in the movie, but he's more complex than that.
That's what I love about Warren William in several of his films from the early 30s. He's terrific at playing a morally compromised character who does bad stuff, but you still find something intriguing about him.
Okay, let's move on to Fog of War, 2003.
Is this the newest film on the list?
I think it is, Greg. Yeah,
I think this is the newest film.
We may have seen this at the Fargo Theater came out. McNamara.
Yeah, yes. And it's sort of it uses, you know, so Errol Morris, the great documentarian, loves to play with technique. And I think the memorable component of Fog of War is that he incorporates this device he patented called the Interatron, which is it uses kind of a teleprompter style system so that he can have interview subjects see his face, but they're looking directly into the lens of the camera when they do their interviews. So it's very unsettling to have Robert McNamara holding eye contact with you as he tells about he unspools all this insider stuff from his time in government.
That is clever. Wow, I didn't even know that. I'll be looking for that.
When you watch the film, too, I almost see it as a soul-bearing therapy session for Robert McNamara to get all this off his chest, what went on in Vietnam at the time, both when he served President Kennedy and then LBJ as well.
Yeah, he's very candid.
Mm-hmm.
It won Academy Award for Best Documentary Feature. So, Gaslight. Now, there's a word that has new prominence in the 21st century, but this is a film from 1944.
So what gaslighting means is you're convincing somebody either that something happened or it didn't happen, and you're so convincing that the person begins to believe it. And that's what Charles Boyer does to Ingrid Bergman in this movie. he's attempting to make her go insane. Now, this is a remake of a British picture with Diana Wynyard and Anton Walbrook.
Yeah, that's
from
right.
1940. Sorry about that.
And Angela Lansbury.
Yes. And so this was the Hollywood remake, a little bit bigger budget. Angela Lansbury's film debut as the maid gets her an Oscar nomination at age 19. Joseph Cotten's in it. So this is a typical, you know, big budget period film of the 40s.
And this was another huge opportunity for Ingrid Bergman, who wins a Best Actress Oscar. So another one on our list of Best Actress Oscar winners.
And the director, George Cukor, pretty well-known guy.
He was a great director who famously was hired as the original director on Gone with the Wind and was replaced by Victor Fleming. But Olivia de Havilland and Vivian Leigh liked Cukor so much that we hear during the filming of Gone with the Wind, they still met with him on days off as he coached them on their performances of Scarlett and Melanie.
All right. The next one is another piece of history. George Washington Carver at Tuskegee Institute, 1937. This is a short subject.
It's only 12 minutes long. This is the only, I believe this is the only film on this year's registry that does not have a credited director, at least as far as the Internet Movie Database, unless they need to update that. I could not find a director credited for this particular documentary.
It's an African-American surgeon from Michigan by the name of Alan Alexander.
Is the director of the film?
Well, he was basically shooting home movies.
Fantastic. Okay. Yeah. Well, hopefully IMDb can get that updated. That should be in there.
And it's footage of Mr. Carver next to a statue of Booker T. Washington. That's one scene I remember. But I believe this is the only film footage available of George Washington Carver.
And you see Tuskegee Institute. You see a football game, a marching band, majorettes. And this one has been digitized. So obviously lots of other people will be able to see it now thanks to the National Film Institute and the National Film Preservation Act. Next on the list is Girlfriends, 1978.
This is a fascinating movie that I saw on Turner Classic Movies about a year ago, directed by Claudia Weill, another woman director who had a very low budget for this. It took her 3 years to finish the movie. Melanie Mayron is in it. Christopher Guest from Best in Show fame and Spinal Tap fame is in the film. And it's a film about two women that are roommates in New York City. One wants to be a photographer. The other eventually gets married in the movie, which kind of fractures their relationship. But it's a fascinating look at young single women in New York in the late 70s, the kind of film that maybe Woody Allen would shoot. But this time we get it in the hands of a woman director, which gives it that little extra something. And I really enjoyed this. It's low budget, but give it a chance. It's a good film.
I have not seen this one, so Matt has recommended it to me, and I know because Turner Classic Movies has shown it, that's one place to see it. I don't know whether it has had a DVD or Blu-ray release, but I'll have to look into that.
Well, it does touch on those cultural politics of the time more than 40 years ago, Gloria Steinem and sexual freedom and responsibilities and dangers and all that sort of stuff. So the movie is Girlfriends. We got lots more movies to talk about with our experts, Matt Olien and Greg Carlson, and we'll be back with more Main Street after the news.
From the Prairie Public Newsroom, I'm Todd McDonald. An oil company is proposing to use carbon dioxide for enhanced oil recovery in Slope and Bowman counties. Danbury Resources is proposing a 12-inch carbon dioxide pipeline from Montana to the Cedar Hills oil field. The CO2 would come from natural gas plants in Wyoming. The gas would then be injected into those conventional wells with the hope of getting more oil out of them. The Public Service Commission will hold a hearing on the proposal, but commissioners say they like the concept. This is PSC Chairman Brian Crosius.
It not only enhances oil recovery through the secondary recovery process, it helps to repressurize the reservoir and breathes new life into wells that have been depleted or are certainly on the way down. And it also helps reduce emissions at the same time. So you get two very positive benefits when CO2 is injected into oil wells that, frankly, aren't nearly as productive as they once were.
The project would cost $9.2 million, and Danbury hopes to have the pipeline in place by December of 2020. A Colorado-based 3D printer company is moving to North Dakota. The company, Lulzbot, has been acquired by the former Fargo Assembly owners. Ron and Alice Bergen. In making the announcement, Governor Doug Burgum says 15 of the company's original employees will be relocating to Fargo, and hopes are to add another 50 employees after that. Burgum says 3D printing has changed rapidly over the past few years. He says it now has the capability of making major changes to our way of thinking and how we build things.
Lowesbot already has customers using their products where they've taken a manufacturing thing that might have 855 components, and then you start printing those components geometrically, it gets down to 12 components from 855. So the complexity goes away, and then the manufacturing complexity also goes away, and so then it takes less time and energy with less maintenance to be able to assemble super complex things because you're able to design things that literally the only limitation is your imagination.
Officials say Lulzbot will be moving into the former Vanity Clothing Store warehouse in North Fargo. And work is getting underway on a $55 million mixed-use building in downtown Fargo. It's a joint project of the city, Kilbourne Group, and the owners of the Great Northern Depot and Great Northern Bicycle Company. Kilbourne Group President Mike Allmendinger says the project will include a 369-space parking ramp, 100 apartments, and retail at Broadway and 4th Avenue in downtown Fargo, the site of a former Goodyear store.
We've been working on this project for over 3 years, going through the planning stages. And it's a really great project, and I'm excited about the collaboration that's happened. It started with the city of Fargo completing a parking study for downtown Fargo. There was about 3,600 parking spaces in downtown, and they really support the model of having a mixed-use garage that's paid for by the new real estate that's built up around it.
The building will be six stories and will also include a police substation. From the Prairie Public Newsroom, I'm Todd McDonald.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, and today we're talking about the National Film Registry's 25 films picked for 2019 for preservation. We're talking with Matt O'Lean, familiar to our Main Street listeners as our regular film reviewer, and Greg Carlson, a Concordia College film professor. Well, the next movie on our list is I Am Somebody from 1970.
I don't think we've seen this one. Have you seen it, Greg?
No, I have not seen this film. I'm actively seeking it out. It's only 30 minutes long. Mm-hmm. And if I understand correctly, it's the first film of its kind made by a woman of color.
Yes.
It's about a strike at Charleston, South Carolina hospital. Mm-hmm. And it sounds tremendous.
And the majority of the workers striking are African-American women and men. So that's what makes it fascinating. It came out in 1970, so I would really love to see this one.
Yeah, it's really about the front lines of the civil rights movement mm-hmm. at that time. The next movie, The Last Waltz, and you mentioned this, Greg. It came out in 1978. Martin Scorsese is a member of the Film Registry Board.
He is, and certainly this isn't his first movie to make it in to that group of preserved motion pictures. But The Last Waltz is one of the maybe top three or four rock documentary films. It's a concert films. I mean, you feel like you are there on those Thanksgiving Day performances led by Robbie Robertson, Levon Helm, Richard Manuel, the members of the band, Garth Hudson, and Rick Danko. There, I had to say all their names because they're great. But they had a lineup of special guests that were just the royalty of rock music at the time. And I don't know how many times I've watched The Last Waltz, but it's a lot.
Yeah, this is when Greg talks about rock and roll documentaries, certainly Woodstock, Gimme Shelter, and The Last Waltz usually are the first three or so to come out of people's mouths. Very different from those films, especially Gimme Shelter, which has to do with the killings at Altamont. But Last Waltz is a great movie, and if you haven't seen it, it's available.
And it reminds us of those epic concerts. This one was 5 hours long. Okay. The next one is from 1969, a short subject by the name of My Name is Una.
This you can watch online. Gunvor Nelson, I believe, is the director, and he filmed his daughter Una.
Is that is Gunvar a male or a female?
Oh, is that the
I
mom?
I think it's the mom. Yeah, I believe.
Thanks for
yes.
catching that. So it's the mother
yes.
of Una, the little girl who basically is a 9-minute experimental film, which with her saying her name over and over and over, and other things over and over, but it's creepy, don't you think? It's got a creepy sense to it, doesn't it, Greg?
I have not seen this
one.
It's
very
interesting. I'll look forward to it.
Black and white, very interesting.
We'll have to make sure to recommend it to Kaya Christensen-Nelson from MSUM because her daughter is named Una.
That's right.
All right. On to the next movie, A New Leaf, 1971.
Well, we can hope, right, Matt, that Mike Schultz is listening to this show or will listen to this show at some point because his favorite filmmaker is Elaine May. And this is a landmark movie because it, as I understand it, the first time a movie was written, directed, and starring a woman released by a major studio. And who else is in it, Matt?
Walter Matthau is her love interest.
That's
but it's a fascinating movie to watch Elaine May and Walter Matthau kind of go through this odd courtship they're going through. I don't know that Elaine May's other most famous film, Ishtar, will ever make this registry, although Mike claims it's misunderstood. But A New Leaf was generally well-reviewed at the time, and it was a big step forward for Elaine May, who is still winning awards and still spry and active at her age.
On Mike's behalf, I have to say that Ishtar has its supporters. I looked through the list of films that had been nominated for the registry, and Ishtar is on the Library of Congress site as something that's been regularly nominated.
I famously went to see it when it came out. I was the only person laughing in the theater, and the next day I saw somebody who was also at that movie wanted to know who was laughing hysterically at this movie. It's one long actor's joke. That's what it is, actually.
It is.
All right. The next movie I remember from a tender age of 7 or 8, I was bawling in the theater, Old Yeller from 1957.
Yep, like Bill Murray says in Stripes, who cried at Old Yeller? Get those hands up.
Yeah.
We all did. It's a typical Disney animal film of the time. They were making a lot of these at the time, live-action Disney movies. Is Fess Parker in it, Greg, I think?
I can't remember if he plays the dad. Robert Stevenson directed, is that right?
And he was a big Disney director at the time.
This movie, can you imagine the number of 16-millimeter prints that Disney licensed to public and private school, elementary schools and junior highs and high schools for generations, I think. Mm-hmm. You know, how often was this movie shown in a classroom or a gymnasium to a group of kids that would be also bawling by the end of it?
Well, we had a dog named Chipper that looked like Old Yeller. That didn't help. Okay. How about The Phoenix City Story, 1955?
I've seen this one, off Turner Classic Movies. Fascinating film noir of the time. And what it's about is this strange story, true story of this town in Alabama that was run by the mob. And it was there's a part of town where the cops don't go. They just leave it alone. They're on the payroll. And eventually Richard Kiley, who is the lead actor, plays this attorney who tries to clean up the town. And he is assassinated at the end of the movie, which actually happened. And that led to a lot of reform in Alabama about this city. But it's so strange to see a town in the South kind of run by the East Coast mob. But that's what it is. And it's a fascinating film. It's hard to watch because you know bad things are going to happen. But an interesting film noir of the 50s.
All right. The next one is a film that lots of people have seen and talked about. It was controversial when it came out in 1986, Platoon.
Yeah, one of two Vietnam films to win Best Picture. The Deer Hunter was the other. And Platoon, when it came out, it was I remember people saying this is Vietnam the way it was, whereas Apocalypse Now and Deer Hunter were a little different angles, and it won a lot of awards. Willem Dafoe is great in it. Tom Berenger is great in it. I think it's much better than Stone's other Vietnam film, Born on the 4th of July, which I'm not a big fan of. I wonder, you know, I've only seen this film once, though, when it came out. I wonder if it still holds up, Greg.
I haven't seen it for years. Mm-hmm. I have seen it more than once, and I know I have friends who are particularly interested in Vietnam War films, and it's one that, you know, is often in the conversation. Even though I'm a Kubrick fan, I like Full Metal Jacket, but it did win Best Picture and Best Director.
And Oliver Stone, the director, had been in Vietnam. This was sort of based on an experience he had. Okay, our film experts, Madeline and Greg Carlson, are joining us to talk about the 25 selections for this year's 2019 National Film Registry. The next one is big in our part of the country, Purple Rain, 1984.
It is. I'm excited to see Purple Rain on the list. And I was a little bit surprised when they announced the 25 for this year. almost every major outlet from Hollywood Reporter to Variety and beyond led with Purple Rain. That was the picture on the articles that said, you know, 25 films selected for the registry. And I think in part because it was a surprise, it certainly has to do with the fact that Prince recently died. But it's a film that the closest thing to it on the list is The Last Waltz, because it so heavily focuses on or features the electrifying live performances of Prince as the kid in the movie, as this sort of semi-autobiographical piece that it was. I mean, the number, the millions of soundtracks that it sold. I don't think I had a classmate that didn't own a vinyl LP or a cassette of Purple Rain when it came out. And it did win. Here's Matt will know this Oscar trivia, but it was the last film to win an Oscar for best, is it original song score?
Yep,
is that what they
called
it?
That's what it was called, yeah. A strange wording to that category, but it did win, yes.
Well, as you mentioned, the film's multi-platinum soundtrack was named to the Library of Congress National Recording Registry before the film got to the film registry. So it's been there. How about Real Women Have Curves, 2002.
I saw this at the Fargo Theater when it came out, and I enjoyed it very much. It's another one of the films selected this year directed by a woman, Patricia Cardoso, and it's worth seeking out, I think, for people who haven't seen it. It has a real the story is told from through the eyes of a young woman who wants more than what she, you know, is been exposed to in her life.
America Ferrera
is and
the star of the film.
That's
right.
I should have mentioned. Yeah, and sort of like kind of her first.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
Her breakthrough, or her, you know, putting her on the map as a performer.
She was 18. Yeah.
Yep.
So that's a pretty strong start. How about She's Got to Have It, a little Spike Lee from 1986.
His first movie, right, Greg?
His first
feature. Got him, put him
feature,
on the map,
yeah,
low
his first
budget.
Feature
right?
film. And it was such a staple on all of the cable outlets, right, on HBO and Showtime and Cinemax. That was how I first saw it. I didn't get to see it theatrically, and I wouldn't have been old enough to go see it in the theater. And it has immediately established a huge cult following and has been so popular that just in the last couple of years, Netflix has a Spike Lee-produced series based on She's Gotta Have It, with the same characters played by a new generation of actors.
I'm also reminded that he makes this kind of cameo appearance. He's in the movie.
Yeah, it's more than a cameo, right? Oh, he's one of the suitors of Nola Darling. He plays a character named Mars Blackman that is a bike messenger. And we also saw that character develop through a series of advertisements for Nike. You might remember It's Got to Be the Shoes, right,
yeah,
when he's performing with Michael Jordan.
Just think about him in showing up in his movies like Stan Lee does or Alfred Hitchcock, you know. Sleeping Beauty, 1959.
Not one of my favorite Disney animated films. I don't consider this in their classic level. I don't know what Greg thinks. Greg's quite an animation expert. It's a little slower, I think, than some of their real classics of the 50s and 40s, but certainly continues their track record of kind of that Disney princess film. There's a song from the film that was nominated for the Oscar as well, but there's some good sequences, but not maybe my favorite of all Disney.
Well, as I found in my notes, it was the last of the classic animated fairy tale adaptations produced by Walt Disney, so it made the cut, apparently.
Yeah, they got heavily into live action after that, although 101 Dalmatians was 2 years later, but that's not a fairy tale.
Okay, now we're to the 25th movie in our list of 25 selected for the National Film Registry this year, Zoot Suit, 1981. I haven't seen this.
I have not seen this
either.
So this is one that none of the three of us have seen. It was made by Luis Valdez. And I'm trying to remember who's in it. Edward James Olmos? Is that
yes.
James Olmos?
Yes.
Daniel Valdez.
It's about a murder in the 1940s, a Mexican-American wrongly charged, I believe, with the murder. That's the background of it. But this is a film I would dearly like to see, but I've never seen it available.
I think it has a musical score, musical component that's well regarded.
Yes.
And it's innovative in its presentation, according to the National Film Registry, because it's largely a film stage play.
Oh.
So that's interesting. Well, we've got a few minutes left to talk about the film registry and films in general. And I just want to ask the two of you, of the 25 films on this year's list, in your opinion, which is the most important selection?
I think it's important that they are starting to recognize women filmmakers like Claudia Weill, who did Girlfriends, like Patricia Cardoso. So that would be my answer, is I think, you know, certainly women have been underrepresented in the film world over the years as directors. So this is good to see them branching out. Other important films, you know, again, I really like that they put, you know, the Immigrants Landing at Ellis Island. Those are fascinating things that people can now watch.
You know, the Librarian of Congress, Carla Hayden, had a quotation about this year's crop saying, reminding us that these are not necessarily the best films, right? By critical standards. They're meant to represent a huge breadth of American experience spanning the history of the motion pictures. And so I would echo what Matt said about expanding and opening up the selections to include more short subjects, more films made by groups that have not been in the dominant category of classical Hollywood filmmaking. And so I don't know that I would – obviously Purple Rain is my favorite film maybe on the list, but it's an intriguing one because it kind of – its own gender and sexual politics are somewhat suspect, and a reflection of the time in which it came out and was made.
Well, since 1989 now, we've had 775 films named to the National Film Registry. Are you surprised about any film titles that are not on the list?
Well, I would have to look at the entire list. I think they've pretty much captured, you know, the great classic cinema that we expect on there. I would have to look through the whole list to see if there's some glaring omission. I'm sure there's something that I like that has not been preserved, but that doesn't mean it should be preserved either.
Right. When you think of the hundreds and thousands even of films that have been produced that could be contenders for the list, I would – again, invite or remind people that they can visit the Library of Congress website, and there is a section that just indicates a number, dozens of films that have been considered but haven't yet made it into the group.
Okay, this is 2019. Next year there'll be another film registry, and years after that. Have you seen any movies this year that you think will be seriously considered for the film registry?
Well, remember, one of the criteria, as Matt's thinking about his answer, is that this is particular and specific to American films.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So it does not include films that are made outside of the United States. So Parasite is a great film, but it would not be considered for the registry.
I think Once Upon a Time in Hollywood is a quintessential American movie, and Tarantino is a quintessential American filmmaker that some people don't like, but this might be his most gentle film and one of his best films, and he may win the director Oscar for this. We'll see.
Well, you mentioned box office is not the criteria. The criteria is culturally, historically, or aesthetically significant. But we have had these huge movies this year that have set records. So do you think that gives them elbow room into the registry?
I don't know. I think that on each of these forthcoming lists, it won't be a surprise to see one or two each year of these massive blockbusters, like a Marvel Cinematic Universe movie is probably going to be included in the in the registry at some point. The criteria, of course, is that the film has to have been around for at least 10 years.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You mentioned this, Greg, that the National Film Registry is, you know, uniquely American films. That's what we're talking about. Is there anything like an international film registry?
I don't know. That's a great question.
Not sure of that one.
And if there were, for that matter, and it wasn't a registry necessarily that was limited to culturally, historically, or aesthetically significant, but just the best old movie, what would you consider?
Well, you see a lot of films being preserved by their countries of origin, or certainly that become a kind of a national treasure. So, Roberto Rossellini's war trilogy, you know, Rome, Open City, would be one that would join the Italian neorealist classics by De Sica, like Bicycle Thieves,
yeah.
in that country as an example.
Yeah, and France has a lot of great films as well. And, you know, from the UK, I would say The Third Man, Lawrence of Arabia. Lawrence of Arabia might be considered an American film. It was American, you know, the financing was by Columbia, so not sure where that would land.
Well, the film business, to my eyes, and I'm not an expert like you guys, but I go to the movies, has changed in the sense that I'm seeing a lot more big films from other countries that are mainstream in the United States now.
Yeah, they. I mean, look at Parasite. Parasite is a great film that was recently at the Fargo Theater. If people missed it, that is a film they need to see. Pain and Glory is a film people should see by Almodovar, starring Antonio Banderas. I think that's going to get some Oscar nominations. So they're out there, and I think if you open yourself up to watching other cultures on film and get out of that box, some people fall into that box where they can only watch a certain movie. And I find this all the time. And I think if you just let yourself out of that box once in a while, you might find a rewarding experience at the theater.
Well, another box that people kind of get tied into is the actual theater. We've got Netflix and Hulu and Amazon Prime and all these other outlets out there. Is it time to expand the universe as to what we call a film?
I think that's already happening.
Yeah.
I think that you've noticed all kinds of articles and hand-wringing think pieces over whether or not The Irishman is taking up too much real estate, even though it had just a minimal theatrical release before it appeared on Netflix. But the future is here in a sense, and I think more and more of these prestige films are going to be available almost day and date on a streaming platform as they would theatrically.
And the Academy may weigh in on this, Greg, very soon. I think Best Picture is going to come down to The Irishman versus Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, and we will see if Tarantino going the theater route versus Scorsese going the Netflix route, what they favor. I do find it somewhat ironic, even though Greg and I love Martin Scorsese, that he was so critical of Marvel films as not cinematic, and yet he puts The Irishman on Netflix. So he might get penalized for that by the Academy. I don't know. We will see soon.
You know, it occurs to me we've talked about a number of these movies having been shown on Turner Classic Movies, and that's sort of my go-to place for movies. I love to watch it there. Lots of these registry films have been shown on that. What if the Library of Congress Film Registry actually had a channel? They've got 775 movies now.
That'd be great. It'd be great. But I will tell you, Turner Classic has done a great job of running foreign films, odd films. You know, Girlfriends by Claudia Weill, they typically do it after about 11 at night for some reason, but everybody's got a DVR these days, or at least I do. So that's valuable to have. But I do applaud them for seeking out some different kind of films that maybe doesn't fit into the typical Hollywood classic filmmaking.
I love libraries, and librarians are the best people in the world. They are, you know, the lifeline to connecting us with this content. Mm-hmm. And so the Library of Congress National Film Registry project is, you know, Doug's question is really interesting because it does invite the possibility of how we might access this kind of content in the future. We don't know we've seen such radical change technologically. What's the next 10 years going to look like as we watch movies? We all know the best place to see a movie is in the dark in a beautiful theater like the Fargo Theater, but that's not always possible.
That's Greg Carlson, Concordia College film professor, and Matt Olean has been with us, a Prairie Public employee and a Main Street film reviewer. It's always a pleasure to talk about the movies with you two. Thanks for being with us today.
Thanks, Doug.
Decoded 8 Book is next.
Support for this program is provided by North Dakota Horizons, North Dakota's state magazine. Showcasing North Dakota's quality of place, its abundant resources, and people. Learn more on Facebook and at ndhorizons.com.
This is Decoded Datebook for December 18th. The keel of an American battleship to be named after the state of North Dakota was laid on this date in 1907. The ship was the largest ever launched in American waters at the time, measuring 510 feet in length and having a displacement of 20,000 tons. The ship was christened the USS North Dakota at her launching on November 10th the following year. Her sister ship, The USS Delaware was being built at the same time, but was not launched until the following spring. This made the North Dakota a record breaker in battleship construction and the pride of North Dakota. The christening of the ship became an occasion to celebrate and was highly publicized. Miss Mary Benton, daughter of Colonel John Benton of Fargo, was selected by Governor John Burke to be the sponsor of the ship during the christening in Massachusetts. Miss Benton was accompanied by her chaperone, Mrs. Alice Page Nelson of Grand Forks, along with Governor Burke and a party of prominent North Dakotans. As society editor of the Grand Forks Herald, Mrs. Nelson was selected as a suitable chaperone by Governor Burke. Being as publicized as it was, the christening of the battleship elicited some controversy. Under Prohibition at the time, many North Dakotans felt the use of champagne for the christening to be rather inappropriate. Because of this, Elizabeth Preston, president of the Women's Christian Temperance Union, wrote to Senator Hansbrough, urging him to request an alternative to the alcoholic beverage. Secretary Jackson of the Williston Commercial Club offered some water from the new Missouri irrigation plant. In the end, the ship company chose the traditional wine, but no hard feelings lingered during the joyous occasion. President Roosevelt himself attended the christening, along with the Secretary of the Navy and a bevy of admirals and public officials. Although only 60% complete at the time, the launch was considered a great success, and her completion was accomplished by the following June. Today's Dakota Datebook is written by Jamie Jobe. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
There will be other presidential campaigns, and I'll be there.
Joe Biden ended his first presidential campaign after he was caught borrowing his stump speech from a British politician. But as the chair of the Senate Judiciary Committee during the nomination for Robert Bork, Biden had a graceful exit from the campaign.
He had to get rid of the running for president, or his running that committee would not have worked.
That story on the next Morning Edition from NPR News.
Starting at 4 a.m. Central, right here on Prairie Public.
Thursday on Main Street, legendary wildlife biologist and buffalo rancher Dan O'Brien discusses his classic work of nonfiction, The Rites of Autumn, A Falconer's Journey Across the American West, in a conversation with Sarah Aronson, producer and host of The Right Question from Montana Public Radio and PRX. Also tomorrow, Sue Balcom joins us for Main Street Eats, and we'll look at our What's Happening calendar of events. We hope you can join us for Main Street on Thursday. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your day.